You're listening to Vatican Radio.
The Horn of Africa is currently experiencing an intense cycle of drought and flooding, brought on in significant part by the El Niño and La Niña weather phenomena, which climatologists say are made more intense and more frequent by climate change. Millions of people are already affected, many of whom in the largely agriculture-based societies and economies of the region face a total and permanent loss of their livelihood. A senior technical officer with the FAO Emergency and Rehabilitation Division, Neil Marsland, told Chris Altieri his organization urgently needs help to carry out its mission of helping vulnerable people predict, prepare for, and protect themselves against these increasingly intense phenomena and preserve their way of life.
It's indeed the result of warming of the sea surface temperature in the eastern Pacific. Its classification of an El Niño is when it goes above, the temperature goes above 0.5 degrees Celsius above the average, and we are currently seeing temperatures in the eastern Pacific around 3.5 degrees rather above the average, and so this is classified as a very strong El Niño, the one of the two strongest that's actually ever been recorded, the other being in 1997-98. And yes, it does lead to disruption of weather patterns across the world, resulting in two main things. One is drought and the other is flooding, excessive rainfall. And depending where you are in the world, you will be affected by one or the other, and in some cases both. Both flooding and drought can indeed happen in the same country, in the same region. An example of that is currently the Horn of Africa, where we've had severe flooding in Somalia, and next door in Ethiopia we've had a severe drought.
Two things. One, if we can talk about, and I don't want to get bogged down in numbers, but 2, 3, 3.5 degrees difference in temperature is the sort of thing that a layman might shrug off. Say, you know, I wouldn't even feel that. It wouldn't change, you know, the weight of the jacket I choose in a given season. Why is it such a big deal?
I think it's such a big deal. I mean, I'm not a climatologist, I have to say, but I think it's such a big deal because the temperature of the ocean actually plays a major part in air pressure, and the circulation of different air currents around the globe. So even a small increase in temperature over a pretty large area, because we're talking about a large area of the Pacific here, will have a major impact over a relatively short period of time on those air circulation patterns. It doesn't actually take much for things to become quite disrupted. So where you would have had rain, that is quite delicately balanced, so that if the temperatures aren't right, the wind speeds aren't correct, the rain won't come. And I think this is the reason why we're seeing these impacts. It doesn't really take much, which goes back to the point that, you know, we live in a very delicate ecosystem that you know can be affected by relatively, for us laymen, I classify myself as a layman in that respect, small increases.
You also mentioned La Niña.
Yes. La Niña is the essentially the reverse of El Niño. El Niño meaning little boy or Christ child, and La Niña, little girl. And it's basically where the sea temperature in the Pacific is actually much lower than usual, and this results in the sort of reverse effect. So, for example, where you would be in a part of the world where you'd be having drought, in fact, what happens, you get flooding, and vice versa. And this, as I said earlier, when we were talking to your colleagues, it often comes after a El Niño event.
And it bears mention that a little bit of rain will go a very long way toward creating very difficult conditions in a place that has already, if I could put it this way, been prepared or softened up by an extended drought. So I'm thinking of places like Ethiopia, Eritrea, the Horn of Africa, that go extended periods without seeing any rain whatsoever. The soil is essiccated. Everything is ripe for or ready for a major disaster, and then they get the rains. Might not be a lot of rain. I'll let you pick it up there.
Okay, yes. I think one of the critical things to bear in mind, there are a couple of different effects here. I think one of the most important in many ways is the effect on people's livelihood. So, for example, if you've had a drought, then, you know, people haven't been able to grow crops, their livestock haven't been fattened, they're weak. Many of them have died. People have got poorer, basically, and they're therefore less able to cope with a subsequent shock. So if they don't have their savings have been depleted, their children are malnourished. If another shock comes along, as you say, it doesn't have to be a massive amount of rain, but if something abnormal happens, they're much more vulnerable. Socioeconomically, and indeed, when the rain does come, it can be very sudden, leading to flash flooding and a lot of destruction of assets through that as well. So I think you're right. I mean, basically, we have, with one thing on top of the other, you're getting an exponential effect on people's lives.
The international community, there are several different organs, existing and ad hoc organs, that are dealing with this as best they can. You mentioned, though, a lack of funding when you were talking about, it sounded like, the Horn of Africa specifically and the crises that are there in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Somalia, where you've had some limited success, and I'll ask you about that, too. I guess I'm wondering, is a lack of funding, a lack of resources more generally, is this a material lack or is it more of an organizational lack? Where is what's at the cause of the lack of resources?
Okay, well, I mean, reiterate what I said earlier. I mean, an example is FAO, and by no means we're not the only organization involved. Of course, we work very closely with our international partners, particularly the World Food Programme and our other UN and sister agencies. But, I mean, for us, we have our total requirements for helping with the agricultural impacts of the El Nino at $250 million, and so far we've only been able to raise $15 to $20 million. So that right there it gives you a big size of the an idea of the gap. In terms of the reasons for it, I think what's very important for the listeners to understand is that over the last 10 to 15 years, the amount of money going to humanitarian crises has increased dramatically. There are a lot more crises around the world than even 10, 15 years ago, many of them very expensive, particularly the Syria crisis. We have long-running crises in Somalia, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These tend to use up a lot of donor resources, and of course we're in the situation still of a slump globally. So all these different factors tend to conspire to reduce the amounts of money available for these unexpected, let me say, crises that can be very, very significant. What we're appealing for really is for obviously more resources, and more resources also in given the fact that this type of thing is not going to go away. In fact, predictions are that the El Nino impacts in this current century are going to be double those of the last century. So it's something that we really do have to tackle very, very, very carefully and very, very seriously now.
And these donors would be primarily or principally nation states?
Not just. Also, we have the two types of donors, really, or three, let me say. We have individual nation states, so-called bilateral donors. We also have the multilateral donors, for example, the European Commission is a good example of the multilateral. And then we also have private foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates, Rockefeller, etc. So there's a broad spectrum of donors.
Wherever the money is coming from, It bears mention that the people you're trying to help, the people who are most affected by this, are people who are not well insulated against this sort of phenomenon. People who are under the best of circumstances in a fairly precarious state or condition of life to begin with. The difference between a reasonably prosperous season and disaster is on a razor's edge very often. Can you maybe paint us the picture then of how a weather phenomenon like this, a little less or a little more rain, affects the people that it affects most powerfully?
Absolutely. I mean, to give you a very good example, we have large sections of the world's population depend upon cereal crops for their basic staple food. Example in many parts of Africa is maize or corn, and that's actually quite a sensitive crop to rainfall patterns, not just in terms of drought, but in terms of, if you like, erratic rainfall. So, for example, there are times in the growing cycle of that plant which are particularly susceptible to a gap in rainfall. So when the plant reaches what's called a tasseling stage, is when you get those bits that come up the top of the cob. If that is very, very sensitive, if the rain stops there even for 10 days, the plant can die, or it can be in such a state that it won't recover and it won't be able to produce the amount of grain that you'd expecting. So that's just an example of how important not just the amount of rainfall, but when it happens, is for farmers, for livestock owners as well. It's very important that that the rains fall sufficient rains fall enough to regenerate pastures, because what tends to happen is that you have with the rainy seasons, obviously with the rainfalls, the pastures regenerate. This is what the animals eat, which gives them the strength to get themselves through the next season, start producing milk. This is when the animals will become pregnant and start producing calves and kidding, etc. So if the rain doesn't fall in sufficient quantities, then it leads to all these kind of a contagion effect, if you like, of weakened livestock, less productivity. Then the livestock are more vulnerable to something else happening to disease, for example. The same thing with crops. If the crops fail, or even if you get a reduction in yield, the farmers will not be able to repay their debts. They won't be able to have enough money to send their kids to school, and it just spirals from there. So this is why it is quite precarious. And as I was saying earlier, one of the things that we found is that the agricultural sector bears the disproportionate impact of these types of weather phenomena.
Given the scientific consensus about the permanence of these changes in weather patterns, in the increase in both intensity and frequency of these severe weather events, are the agricultural models that are in place in the places where you're trying to help really, at the end of the day, sustainable?
I think that's a very good question. I think clearly these weather patterns, what's going on, are creating huge challenges for these agricultural systems. And what we need to do collectively as an international, national, local communities is trying to make these systems more resilient to the effects of extreme climate. And I think the way in which we in FAO are trying to help with that is really operating on around four pillars. First of all, we're trying to work with the governments at the policy level. So helping them create policies which can help different players, most importantly communities, to become more resilient to climate change by implementing various measures around what's called disaster risk reduction. The second element is to try and really strengthen early warning systems of information about when a weather phenomenon is on its way, having better ways of looking at the likely impact of such events. The third way is working very much at community level, if you like, in peacetime, by which I mean before, where we know we're in an area that's prone to different types of disasters, we can work with communities to, again, make them more prepared for the next disaster. And that can range many things. It can be, for example, helping them with flood defences, making sure that they are have a broader basket of crops that can that, so if one crop is hit by something, they've got others to rely upon. We're also looking at insurance, ways of supporting them with insurance systems. And the final way is that we're trying to become much more agile at actually dealing with a situation when it happens, so to minimize suffering and try and accelerate the process of recovery.
If there is one thing, there may not be one thing, there may be three, but you'll understand the spirit of the question anyway, that the FAO needs people, desires that people in our broader listenership understand about this crisis, what would that be?
I think what's very important to understand is, a few points. Firstly, that, as we mentioned earlier, it's not going away. We've talked about the impact of climate change, the fact that the frequency and severity of these events is predicted to increase this century. So we really need to find ways of increasing people's resilience to these types of events through adapting existing systems of farming and ways of looking after livestock. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we're dealing with a situation in which the impact of this phenomenon, as we were saying earlier, on agriculture is also extremely high. So we would like to see increasing attention paid to that very point. And when we're talking about El Niño, to be looking at the ways in which the agricultural sector can become better equipped to deal with this. The third thing I'd like to say is that, as we were again mentioning earlier, the El Niño is often followed by a La Niña. So, you know, this is something that which we need to be very vigilant about.
And the FAO, if there's one thing that the FAO needs right now in order to do its work, to accomplish its mission, what would that be? And what can maybe folks at home do to make sure you get it?
Well, I think we certainly need more funding for the work that we're trying to do around the globe in relation to this phenomenon. And I think that's a very important point. I'd also like to say to the listeners that, you know, again, this is something that I feel that the agriculturalists and the agricultural sector can play a very important role in preventing suffering. But, you know, along with our colleagues who are working more to provide on providing food, we can help with actually growing food and providing people with a means to get back on their feet. So we'd like, you know, obviously welcoming any support that can be given in that regard.
You also mentioned the work that you do in concert with your local partners, with international partners, with non-governmental organizations, because we are here where we are. I wanted to ask you, what do Catholic organizations, of which there are many and they're quite active on the ground, they have relationships already built, and more broadly, faith-based charitable concerns, etc. What is your partnership like with them?
I'd say we have a very close partnership with our faith-based organizations. To give you an example, we have been collaborating very closely with CRS in Ethiopia on looking at the availability of seed for planting next season. This is a partnership that which we very much value.
CRS being the Catholic Relief Services, the charitable, the international charitable wing of the U.S. bishops.
Exactly.
The area where your presentation was most concerned, it was by no means limited to that, was the Horn of Africa. You talked about Ethiopia quite specifically and in a good bit of detail. One of the things that did emerge from your presentation, though, is that the political and social conditions in which you're working in the Horn of Africa can range from the very good on an institutional level to the non-existent. You know, I'm thinking of Kenya and Ethiopia are not Somalia, and neither is Eritrea in terms of, you know, Eritrea being a very closed society.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya and Ethiopia having a bit of a more stable governing structure, government in place, and also civil society to some extent, and Somalia, where the government in large swathes of the country exists on paper. How does that complicate your work?
Well, I think what's very important to note is that, yes, indeed, we have to be very flexible in the way that we work with our partners, government, non-governmental, our other UN agencies in these different circumstances. I mean, clearly in Ethiopia, and as I was saying earlier, with relation to this current El Nino, they've been leading the way, really, and we've been very much supporting them. In Somalia, it's a different situation because, as you rightly said, in large parts of the country, there aren't the same, there's not the same level of government leadership or indeed presence that we find in other parts of the region, and so we tend to operate more closely there with our local NGO partners, and we can reach the communities, let's say, in a very direct way through those partnerships.
And I mentioned Somalia also because if I remember correctly, I heard you talking about it as being one of the places in which you've had one of your more important success stories of late.
Yes, thank you. Yes, basically, what happened in Somalia was very interesting. We sort of raised the flag about the impact of El Nino on the weather patterns there rather early, and the main impact is indeed flooding, excessive rains, and we were very happy to get a donation from USAID, the American aid donor, state aid donor, and which allowed us to shore up some riverbanks in the country, in the part of the country affected by, which was going to be affected by flooding, which meant that when the flooding came, there was much less destruction than there would have been. And I think this really raises the importance of taking early action on the basis of early warning. If we do that, then we can really reduce the amount of impact. And therefore, the amount of money, the amount of people involved, the cost to people's livelihoods. So acting early, I think, is very important in these sorts of situations.
That was Neil Marsland, Senior Technical Officer with the FAO Emergency and Rehabilitation Division. He was speaking with Chris Altieri.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.